rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Schmidt, Judge Smith, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date, for the sake of the audio record, is January 4, 2024. This panel of the court today has four cases set for oral argument, and counsel are present and ready for the first case, so I will call that case. First case is number A23-664, Central Specialties, Inc. versus Minnesota Department of Transportation. As counsel know, each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is William Young. I'm an Assistant Attorney General here on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. There's two issues in this case, Your Honors, and I first want to discuss briefly the Prompt Payment Act. There's a question of whether the Prompt Payment Act applies to construction contracts under its plain language. This issue is important to MnDOT. We have other cases in which this interpretation needs to be resolved, but I would fully rest on our briefing, and if there's no other questions, I'm going to pivot to the second main issue, our bigger issue in our mind, which is the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in the contract.
Well, since you're on that issue, and maybe I'll ask you a question. I don't believe you responded to respondents' argument at page 44 of their brief. Yeah, it might help if you refer to that.
Oop, wrong one. Sorry, Your Honor.
I don't think there was an argument in their responsive brief that I believe you did not address in your reply. It's at the bottom of page 44 of the respondent's brief. And their point is that this is not a disputed claim, but rather it's an agreed upon amount, it's undisputed, and therefore it's not a claim, as that word is used in that key sentence of subdivision 5E. I believe that's the argument, and I'm just wondering if you have a rebuttal to that.
Yes, Your Honor. The final sentence of subdivision 5E is very explicit that all claims made under a construction contract, the interest penalties do not accrue for all claims made under a construction contract. The disputed language comes, I think, four or five sentences earlier. It requires grabbing the word undisputed from somewhere else in the subdivision and applying it to that final sentence, which is an unambiguous sentence as written. And so MnDOT's response or MnDOT's argument would be, the undisputed language comes from elsewhere in the statute, and this final sentence of subdivision 5E is a clear, unambiguous articulation of legislative intent, and other language should not be grafted from elsewhere to help interpret an unambiguous statute that doesn't need further interpretation.
But the word claims is used in the last sentence of 5E, and I believe it's not used anywhere else in 5E or in 5. So what does that mean, claims?
A claim is a request for payment. And so and this count three of this complaint is a request for payment under the construction contract. And so the interpretation we would put forth would be a claim is a request for additional compensation above what's already been paid by the construction, the owner of the construction project.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Your Honor. Pivoting to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the question before this court is whether MnDOT breached the contract's implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing when exercising its discretion in accordance with the contract. Several contract principles must be considered by this court in helping interpret and resolve this dispute. First, a party generally cannot breach a contract by complying with the contract. If the language of the contract entitles a party to do something, doing that action in and of itself is not a breach of the contract. The Sterling Capital case is directly on point. There's many cases on point that just acting precisely in accordance with the contract is not in and of itself breaching a contract. Second, the terms of an unambiguous contract govern the party's dispute. When the terms are unambiguous, parties shouldn't be looking to prior course of conduct to amend those terms or to change those terms when there's a written final contract that's fully integrated. Prior course of conduct is frankly irrelevant to that interpretation. Third, there was no ambiguity in this contract. Standard specification 15.
Can I interrupt you, Mr. Young? It seems like you're arguing a claim of sort of a straightforward breach of contract, but the claim here is breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's one of the complicating factors of this case is that from the very beginning, MnDOT's position has been the plain language of the contract allows it to use its exercise its discretion. The engineer can determine whether the roads are acceptable or not. And not approving a road is not in and of itself a basis for contract revision. So simply making a determination that the contract assigns to the engineer cannot in and of itself be a breach of the contract. There needs to be something further.
Wait a minute.
That's the good faith.
Okay, go ahead.
And so a party can breach a contract, assuming Minnesota law is in accord with pretty much all the other jurisdictions. It's never been expressly answered by the Minnesota Supreme Court, but MnDOT assumes that a party still has to follow the implied covenant to good faith and fair dealing, even when it's afforded discretion. But it can only breach the contract by acting in bad faith. Its discretion must be exercised in bad faith. And that's the dispute here.
I think what you mean is can only breach the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing with bad faith. I think you're using the term breach of contract, I think, overly broadly. I think it's distinct from the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Am I wrong about that?
You're not. I would just posit that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is basically adding that good faith requirement to the contract. So while it's not written in the contract, it's impliedly part of the contract, is that they must exercise it in good faith. And so while I say breach of contract...
But it helps to be particular.
Yes, and I appreciate the clarification, Your Honor. You are correct that there's no actual contract language being breached. It would be the implied covenant to good faith and fair dealing that would have been breached if MnDOT exercised its discretion in bad faith.
So do you acknowledge that the federal court's decision in Whitestone is contrary to your argument? Would you agree?
I would disagree, Your Honor. The federal court in Whitestone did say that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing does apply to discretionary contracts. It said, while it's not clear in Minnesota, there's no reason to believe it wouldn't apply. And so MnDOT's operated on the position that it must have acted in good faith. But Whitestone then goes on to look at all the different cases in Minnesota that have considered the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing and said, to act in bad faith when exercising discretion, it can't just have been an unreasonable decision or a negligent decision or a mistaken decision. It's got to be a dishonest decision, an improper decision. And that's what's been lacking here from the very beginning. CSI has argued consistently, for example, during MnDOT's Rule 50 motion partway through trial, they said, it doesn't matter. Acceptable means if we think it's good enough, it's good enough. We mean Central Specialties. That is not the language of the contract. So CSI has been attempting to rewrite the contract from the very beginning, and that's why I started with those principles of contract law today, Your Honor, is that at the outset, we must follow the language of the contract with the understanding that it can only be breached with this clear discretion, the clear assignment of discretion to the engineer. The contract, the implied covenant can only be breached if the discretion was exercised in bad faith. And then the question becomes, what does that mean? How do you exercise your discretion in bad faith?
And let me jump ahead then. You're spending a lot of time on doctrine, but if the standard... If the question comes down to whether MnDOT had an ulterior motive, if that's the standard, can you prevail under that standard on this appeal?
I believe so, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, I don't believe that ulterior motive is the right standard, but under
I know,
that,
but
under
that assuming question, for the moment that it is,
you can still have an ulterior motive, which just simply means just an unspoken motive. That's still a proper motive. The standard needs to be a dishonest ulterior motive, a motive that evades the spirit of the contract. It's an improper purpose. You're trying to get out of the contract. You're trying to renegotiate the terms and not get what the parties bargained for and agreed upon. And so in doing so, you're acting dishonestly or fraudulently or trying to evade. There's two examples of cases in which sort of an improper motive was found. One of them is the case, give me just one moment here, Your Honor. There was the case... In the Hennepin County bond litigation case, the Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1995, a party failed to seek a renewed letter of credit because they were trying to cause a condition precedent to fail. And that way they could get out because the terms of the market had changed. And so they didn't like the bonding agreement that had been agreed upon with the lender for this, or for the development of the recycling facility. And so basically they were trying to provoke a condition precedent. They weren't doing it because of any sort of honest purpose. They were trying to cause something to fail. That's not the case here. MnDOT wasn't trying to prevent CSI from being able to fulfill the work of this project or being able to haul material for the roads. They approved a lot of the roads. They approved most of the roads that were requested, and they also approved roads to get from the Christensen pit to the project itself, slightly further distance, but it wasn't as if they made it impossible to carry out or substantially more difficult. The spirit of the contract was still followed. MnDOT did exactly what the contract afforded them to do. The other case would be the Whitestone case you already talked about, Your Honor. And I first would note that that's a Rule 12 motion, so it came on a different procedural posture. But there the allegations were a party would approve, they would rely on an environmental assessment, and they would also rely mainly an environmental assessment, and an MAI appraisal for whether property was acceptable. And here the environmental assessments came back, there was no issue whatsoever with the assessment. And they said, yeah, but they still opted out of the deal because they now found that the market had turned and they put forward no reason to not rely on those assessments. And so it must have been, the allegations were that it was dishonest. So again, that was Rule 12 versus after a jury trial or after summary judgment or whatever standard, the Rule 50 motion halfway through this case. Here there were no allegations that MnDOT acted dishonestly, that MnDOT acted fraudulently, that they were trying to renegotiate or get out of the terms of the deal. MnDOT was just following the contract as written. And so this case is fundamentally different from those two cases where courts have said this could be bad faith when exercising discretion.
How do we deal with the argument that you forfeited your argument by agreeing to the jury instructions using ulterior motive as a standard?
Well, for one thing, Your Honor, I don't believe this case should have even gotten to a jury because there was a Rule 50 motion brought halfway through trial when, so let me answer that kind of from a farther step back. Bad faith is a question of fact, but the legal standard for bad faith is a question of law, and then you must apply that law to the facts, and that's from the Reinbinger case. And so here, when the standard of law is applied as to what is bad faith, there were no facts to support it, so it shouldn't.
Attention, attention. There has been an emergency reported in the building. Proceed immediately in an orderly manner to the nearest exit and leave the building.
I think we will.
Attention.
To be in recess.
Reported in the building. Proceed immediately in an orderly manner to the nearest exit and leave the building.
That's a first.
I think we will be in recess. If I thought that there was an advantage to do so, I would invite council to come back to our secured space.
Proceed immediately in an orderly manner.
But in light of the instruction to leave the building, I assume that. It's appropriate for you to leave that way. But I will stand here for a minute at this door with the door open if you wish to come back and go into the secured space.
Your Honor, may I bring my colleague?
All rise. The court is back in session. Judge Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Okay. After a short unscheduled recess, we are back in the courtroom and ready to continue. The clock says that appellant has about 3.5 minutes remaining. Might have been more time when the alarm first rang, so I'll be flexible about that. I don't know. I think we all have taken notes and can be oriented where we were. My notes indicate that Judge Smith had a question about whether an argument of appellant was forfeited, and I believe that appellant's counsel was in the midst of answering that question, maybe if that's helpful to anybody. But otherwise, Mr. Young, you should feel free to pick up either where you left off or wherever you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor, and glad to be back. Thank you for reorienting me on the question. I knew there was a question from Judge Smith, and I couldn't quite recall if I had answered it or where we were, but I believe I was partway through the answer. And so to answer your question, Your Honor, in a couple ways. First of all, MnDOT argued from the very beginning of this case at the summary judgment standard all the way through the Rule 50 motion after the trial. In our reply brief, we detailed 10 different times we argued that that MnDOT could not have breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing by exercising its discretion unless it exercised its discretion in bad faith. So there's simply no way that MnDOT could have forfeited this argument when it argued it repeatedly over and over and over again, and it was the issue at trial. Now, the other question, I think the other part of that component, the other component of that question is about the jury instructions as a whole. And that's where I was noting there was no reason for a jury to even decide this because the legal standard for bad faith is a question of fact, as in the Reinbinger case. And when you apply that legal standard that the
question of fact or law?
I'm sorry, it's a question of law. And then once you have that standard, then you apply the facts to that case. But when the legal standard is properly applied here, and it's a de novo review for this court, the standard as articulated by the federal court in synthesizing Minnesota law in Whitestone and in the BP products case, there is no dishonest motive, there is no fraudulent motive, there is no motive to harm Central Specialties. Even if MnDOT's decision was mistaken, even if the jury would have made a different decision, even if any of your honors would have made a different decision, even if I would have made a different decision, that's not relevant. What's relevant is, did MnDOT have a good faith basis for its decision, or was it made based upon willful wrongfulness? Were they trying to get out of the contract? Were they trying to harm CSI? Were they trying to evade the spirit of what the parties bargained for? And there's no facts to suggest that's what happened here. And there were no facts at summary judgment. There was no facts during CSI's case in chief. There was no facts all the way through trial. It's just somebody, an expert, got up on behalf of CSI and said, I would have made a different decision. That's not enough, because that doesn't afford MnDOT the contractual protection it has in the contract of getting to make that decision. We don't supplement MnDOT's discretion with somebody else's discretion. The parties agreed who would be the arbiter, like in the Boyd case from 1895, where the parties agree on who the arbiter of title is, or in the 451 case, where they said the Office of Corporate Counsel gets to determine whether these are sufficient legal documents. When the parties decide who makes that call, as long as that call is made in good faith, that is not a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Would it still be good faith if the decision was made based on a coin flip?
I don't necessarily think so, Your Honor. I think a coin flip could be that arbitrary with no basis whatsoever if it's just a 50-50 and I don't have any reason whatsoever. But here the contract said the engineer could consider other factors as well as facts and inferences. And so surely the engineer should be able to exercise his discretion by talking to the most knowledgeable person in the world about these roads, listening to him, taking in his concerns, and not necessarily rubber stamping them, but going and doing an independent investigation. Well, but we don't just have a coin flip here. We have much more than that.
Let's say Mr. Large says, I'm only going to lift these weight restrictions if you pave this with gold after the project is completed. And does MnDOT have to, if he's being so unreasonable, does MnDOT have to still go along with that? And they say, all right, fine, we're not even going to go down this road because you're being just so obstructive.
No, MnDOT doesn't have to defer to Mr. Large at all. MnDOT could have, from the very beginning, rejected what Mr. Large said and completely ignored him. I see I'm out of time. May I continue to answer, Your Honor?
Yes, you may finish your answer.
MnDOT could have just ignored John Large completely. They didn't have to listen to him. And in fact, the record reflects they didn't just listen to him. They went and independently verified. And in one instance, they approved a road that he didn't want approved. They actually rejected his recommendation or his suggestion. So if Mr. Large was just being completely unreasonable and said, it has to be paved in gold, or I don't want you to use any roads that are even numbers because even numbers are unlucky, you know, that's preposterous. There would be no basis. But that's not what we have here. Thank you, Your Honors. I'll return for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Young. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Actually, move this around a little bit, Your Honors. I've already spilled the water once, so I'm going to be very careful. The prompt payment interest issue I'm going to address very briefly because it was only discussed for a few minutes, but it is important. It's a small amount of money in this case, but it does have dramatic repercussions for the entire construction industry, anyone who does work for the state or a state agency. And I think Judge Johnson had it exactly right. You cannot read that statute in any other way other than to say the word claim means a disputed claim. In the construction industry, that's the way it works. You have claims, which are disputed, and you have amounts that are agreed upon, which are not claims. They are agreed upon. And that's what the statute is all about. In fact, the statute in various parts says undisputed amounts are entitled to prompt payment interest, and claims are not. They were merely clarifying that by adding the paragraph in the sentence in 5E.
I have a question, a follow-up question to that. I guess even under your view of the meaning of the statute, doesn't it still beg the question, perhaps, about whether this amount due is for a claim made by a contractor under a construction contract? And I understand that there was a dispute, and then there was a settlement agreement, I believe, and so what you're asking for is prompt payment of the amount of the settlement.
Correct.
But, of course, underlying the settlement is a construction contract. So given those facts, how does the statute apply?
Well, at the point it was agreed upon in a settlement agreement, it was no longer a claim. It was an amount that was owed under the construction contract. And if you look at it, states in subdivision 1, it says that subdivision 8 states specifically that the statute applies, subdivision 1 to 7 apply to all agency contracts, including construction and remodeling contracts. There's just no way you can look at that any other way. And the canons that the DOT is asking you to look at only come to play if you can't reconcile the words. And you can reconcile them by using the common industry distinction between a claim and an amount that is admittedly owed and due.
Before you move on from that, I think I recall appellant's counsel saying that because of the Prompt Payment Act, we should consider issuing a precedential opinion. I don't recall if you took a position on that.
You know, we're fine with a precedential opinion. I mean, it's not going to affect my client, Central Specialties. It was a $7,000 claim or something like that. It was very small. So it's not significant in the course of this case. But the whole construction industry will be watching this. And I imagine no matter what you say, it will go to the Supreme Court and there'll be amicus curiae briefs and everything else on this issue. So I think a precedential decision is fine. Now I'll get to the heart of the matter, at least from our perspective. The trial court judge in this case was Senior Judge Kurt J. Marbin. He is a widely respected and experienced trial judge. In 2010, he was named the Minnesota Trial Judge of the Year by the American Board of Trial Advocates. And in preparing for today's argument, I found it hard to improve on his order denying the DOT's post-trial motions. First of all, it was short. Other than the order, it was 11 pages long. It's very well done, concisely states the facts, why the facts and the law require affirmance. And I encourage you to reread it as many times as you can, because he knew what he was doing. He was a great trial judge, and he issued an excellent order denying the DOT's post-trial motions. In this case, Judge Marbin correctly instructed the jury that the DOT's sole discretion over haul road designations was nonetheless constrained by the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And that's supported by the case law that we've cited in our brief, including the 451 case, the Olson versus Farm Credit case.
Let me ask this. If it's a question of law, then are the jury instructions really irrelevant?
Well, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What would be the question of law that you think was dispositive here?
Well, the question is whether you alter your motive requires bad faith.
Okay.
That's what we're dealing with.
That's the gist of the whole case here.
Yep.
And what I would point out is that issue has been completely waived. If you look at the jury instructions that were agreed upon, 100% with regard to good faith and fair dealing, the DOT didn't have one objection. In fact, Judge Marbin, he asked them specifically. Here's what he said. It's at page 751. Judge Marbin goes at line 15. He goes, Mr. Gross, Does the defense have any objection, additions, or corrections to the jury instructions? And the Department of Transportation had some problems with the ambiguity instruction, but not a single complaint about the fair, good faith and fair dealing instruction.
But if the MnDOT had been granted summary judgment, it wouldn't be relevant.
Okay.
And they didn't raise that.
I understand that, but I think the case law does not support the notion that you have to have a malice or an intent to harm somebody or a fraud.
Well, I understand that's your position, but if summary judgment is granted, then the jury instructions aren't relevant.
Correct, but I think, Your Honor, you
made it at the beginning.
You've been doing this longer than I have, but my understanding is that you don't appeal denials of summary judgment. What you appeal is a jury verdict. And the jury is the one whether somebody acts in bad faith is inherently factual. And that's what the jury is best suited to decide. They weighed all of the evidence, and Judge Marburn did too. He listened to all the evidence. There was 11 witnesses, 4 days of trial, hundreds of exhibits, and a jury. And they all decided that MnDOT, the DOT, acted in bad faith in rejecting.
They decided that it was an ulterior motive.
Well, so right. The case law, yes. The case law identifies subjective bad faith and ulterior motive as the same thing. If you look at the case law, including the BP case that the DOT likes to rely on, they equate subjective bad faith and ulterior motive as being one and the same thing.
As I recall, there's our case law says that one way to prove a breach of the implied covenant in good faith, fair dealing, is to show that a party refused to abide by its contractual obligations due to an ulterior motive, or words to that effect.
Yes.
So is that what it comes down to here? I mean, in your view, is that the question is whether there is evidence that's sufficient as a matter of law to prove an ulterior motive?
Once again, we don't have to prove anything as a matter of law. Well, we got the jury verdict. We had it sustained on post-trial motions. What we're here to talk about today, as in my view anyway, is could a jury have found that there was bad faith?
And if I'm reading the record correctly, I think that you attempted to prove bad faith by proving an ulterior motive. Is that correct?
Correct. That was.
And so, I mean, the issue for us, I mean, on appeal, we have to decide whether, as a matter of law, the evidence is legally sufficient.
Correct.
So and I think that requires an understanding of the legal standard. And so, I mean, if the legal standard is ulterior motive, or if that's a critical part of it, isn't it fair to frame the issue that way?
I think so. But you have to use the correct standard. And could a jury, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Central Specialties and the verdict that Judge Marvin affirmed and their judgment on, could a reasonable jury have found that there was bad faith, as they were instructed? And in our case, we thought the easiest way to prove this, juries don't like to find somebody guilty of fraud, so the best way to do it was to find evidence that MnDOT had an ulterior purpose, which was clearly proven. I mean, it's even
so,
beyond.
So let me ask, I mean, it seems to me that you did not attempt to prove bad faith in any other way except by proving an ulterior motive, correct?
Well, that's not quite true. I mean, they like to point to my closing argument as I was explaining to the jury that, hey, here's where I think you can look and find it the easiest. But we think their decision to act in an ulterior motive was dishonest. They didn't tell us the truth about what they were doing. They said, we think these roads are, they told us Highway 6 was not good. They told us we couldn't use 5 and 10 because it was going to be used by Knife River. And that was their story. But when the evidence came in at trial, the evidence was to the contrary. It was the real reason, admitted by MnDOT representatives, that the reason they didn't grant us the haul roads was because they were into a feud with John Large and other county engineers around the state who were disputing the way that they handled restoration of haul roads, and they wanted to placate them. If you look at Exhibit 46...
Can I back up a minute? So what does ulterior motive mean? First of all, how do we figure out what that means? And how would you define ulterior motive?
I think Judge Marvin did a great job of that. And here's what he said in his order denying their post-trial motions, the DOT's post-trial motions. He said the reason that they denied their haul roads was not because of an engineering judgment, which is required by what they argued. MnDOT argued that the Min specs, it's a book about this thick, and it has all these specifications, and the one that the DOT relied on was 1501.3, basis of decision. And that says the engineer will make decisions based on engineering judgment. In this case, this was not an engineering judgment. This was a political decision. It had nothing to do with the roads. There was plenty of evidence in the record, including from Alex Sweep, who was the project manager for Central, Alan Minerath, who was the chief executive officer of Central Specialties, Bill Kwasny, who was an expert that Central Specialties retained to testify, and they all said the roads were fine. They were not unusual.
But am I correct? There's evidence that MnDOT's engineer did an investigation which included some tests, I mean, some kind of machine that pounded on it, and they measured something and so on.
After the fact.
I'm sorry?
After the fact. Those tests were done after they had already told us that the roads were being denied. It's like a ex post facto finding, whatever. Those tests, actually, if you actually look at my closing argument, I was able to explain to the jury why those tests didn't even support their position. The weight that those tests said the roads were suitable of holding were more than satisfied by what Central Specialties was going to be hauling on those roads. So the best way to say this is there was evidence from which a jury could conclude that the decision was not based on an engineering judgment about how good the roads or bad the roads were, but rather it was trying to appease Mr. Large. Look at Exhibit 40.
Isn't that just another way of saying that MnDOT designated these as haul roads, then MnDOT had potential liability to restore the roads, right?
And so did Central Specialties. The way it works, Your Honor, is that if a road is damaged during a hauling, the parties, MnDOT and Central Specialties, the contractor, split the cost of fixing it 50-50, if I recall correctly. So both sides had the same incentive, which is why Central Specialties wouldn't pick roads that were bad. Their testimony was that these roads are identical to roads that we have been using for haul roads for 30 years, and they had never been rejected by MnDOT. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, three of them, all three roads that we proposed to use, were rejected. And yes, they were granted. Mr. Young says one of them was granted, and that's true, but it was granted at 7 tons, which means we can't use it. So they said you can use it as a haul road if you want to use a wheelbarrow and drive down the road with it. I'm not sure what the correct word is. It's not a straightforward answer to the question about what happened here. We were not granted access to use the roads we wanted, which deprived us of one of the pits that we wanted to use, which means we had to go find a completely different pit. Our haul roads were longer, and they knew that. You know, to the extent there's required an intent to harm, you know, it may not have been their objective, but they certainly knew that what they were doing was harming us. We complained about it vehemently. We have letters to them saying, hey, we can't use this pit. We've got to drive longer distances. It's going to cost us a pile of money. And it did. It cost us almost $500,000 more money to do this project.
I mean, would you agree that MnDOT is permitted to consider, I mean, both, you know, the public's interest in conserving the roads, not destroying them or not having undue wear and tear, and also MnDOT's own potential liability for restoring them, that those are valid concerns for MnDOT to consider when deciding whether to approve a haul road?
I would say yes, but I would say in 30 years of contracting, nobody from MnDOT could ever find an example where a haul road was denied. And Central Specialties has been in business for longer than that, and they have never had a haul road denied. This was the first time ever that MnDOT said a haul road is not acceptable. And that goes to the ambiguity argument a little bit.
And so was part of your proof that MnDOT was not genuinely, honestly, or earnestly interested in those things I just mentioned, conserving the roads, avoiding potential liability, but that was more like a pretext?
Exactly.
Was that your argument?
Yes. And if you look at Judge Marbrin's opinion, he basically says exactly that. He says there was more than enough evidence that a jury could conclude that MnDOT's decision not to grant haul roads on these three roads was not based on an engineering decision. Rather, it was an effort to placate John Large, the Mahnomen County engineer, who was on the warpath and trying to force MnDOT to give him an agreement in advance that even if the roads weren't damaged, they were going to repair them by doing a certain amount of work.
But is there any evidence that Mr. Large was not earnestly interested in the county's best interest with respect to these roads and damage to the roads and so on?
No, I think Mr. Large was looking out for the county's best interest. He was trying to say, I want to get a deal in advance that tells MnDOT, no matter if these roads are hurt or not, I want, in effect, a new road. And obviously, that's a great deal for them. And MnDOT said, we would never agree to that. And so to get around that, what they said was, we'll just force Central Specialties to go deal with John Large themselves if they want to, but we're not going to designate these roads. And they didn't.
Look at Exhibit
47. It's a very important exhibit where they basically, MnDOT basically admits in Exhibit 47 that what they were doing probably wasn't the right decision. They admitted that on the stand. They said, in hindsight, we probably should have designated these roads. But what that exhibit says, but this will get us out of a tight spot with John Large and Mahnomen County. That's an ulterior motive. It's not based on an engineering judgment. It's based on politics. They were trying to placate John Large. And that's what we argued to the jury. That's what the jury agreed upon. And that's what Judge Marvin said. There was more than enough evidence to sustain that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Mr. Young, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to hit upon a couple of points made by Mr. Hart during his discussion just now. And that circles back to the argument, CSI from the very beginning has basically been trying to rewrite and read words out of the contract that were in the contract from day one. At one point, Mr. Hart said, CSI was not granted access to use the roads we wanted. That doesn't matter under the contract. Yes, CSI gets to request roads, but the contract doesn't require all roads they want to be labeled as haul roads. Otherwise, it's a nullity to have the language in the contract that the MnDOT will determine if the roads are acceptable. It reads the discretion right out of the contract. And that's not how we interpret contracts. Contracts, the words of the contract must be given their effect. Similarly, this has never happened before. That does not in and of itself show a breach and show bad faith. The contract contemplates this exact occurrence happening. So it happening in and of itself is not ipso facto evidence of bad faith. There needs to be more. There needs to be that willful wrongfulness, that dishonesty, that fraudulent purpose where MnDOT's evading the contract. They're trying to get around the contract and not let the parties get what they bargained for.
If ulterior motive is part of plaintiff's requirement of proof, how do we assess whether a motive is ulterior or not ulterior?
And, Your Honor, I think that the right framing is, I think, improper should be the motive, and then ulterior could be one component of improper, just like dishonest, fraudulent. I don't think ulterior in and of itself necessarily equates to improper. Many times it will, but ulterior simply means unstated or you know, not discussed. That doesn't make it in and of itself bad. And so I think that's the issue we get into here, and that's happened over the course of the case from this court, from the Anderson case down to the current jurisprudence, where it started with an ulterior motive, a dishonest motive. There was a comma. They were sort of describing that improper nature. And then over time, honesty sort of just dropped off, and it just became ulterior in and of itself. And the basis should be an improper motive. And that's what's used by, I think, 8 or 9 different jurisdictions across the country. Another jurisdiction uses a bad motive. Another one uses a sinister motive. All of those have that connotation of willful wrongfulness that the Minnesota Supreme Court has said is basically the nature of bad faith. It's like the Justice Stewart line, you know it when you see it. That's one of the issues here is MnDOT does not intend to breach their contracts. And yet under this standard, MnDOT isn't entirely sure what not to do in the future, because if they can't talk to the local county engineer who knows these roads better than anybody, if they can't listen to him and then go and still independently investigate and verify or reject his concerns, what are they supposed to do? Should they just put their head in the sand? And so that surely is something that they should be considering when they're determining whether these roads are acceptable in their discretion.
Is there evidence that CSI was aware of the communications between the county and MnDOT about the county's concerns?
Yes, Your Honor. So the very first time the roads were requested was at the pre-construction meeting. I believe it was April 25th, 2017. It's been so long, the years kind of rolled together, but that was the first meeting. And at that meeting, John Large was present. It's very common for county engineers to be at meetings for MnDOT projects that involve their counties. And he spoke up right away and said, hey, there might be some concerns with these roads. We got some problems. First of all, two of them are going to be under construction. They're going to be getting closed and mill and overlaid themselves. So it doesn't seem like a good idea to be sending all these trucks through a closed active construction site where I've got my own $1 million contract going on. But right after that, emails, there's flurries of emails back and forth, and those were all exhibits in the trial record as well after that pre-construction meeting of MnDOT saying, I think it was 2 or 3 days later, hey, have you looked at other alternatives to CSI? It looks like those ones aren't going to work. They're going to be closed. Now, admittedly, six wasn't closed, but the two issues with six were, one, it was in very poor shape as confirmed by the testing, both MnDOT's testing, the pavement van that their own expert looked at and said, yeah, it's not the best road. I think it could be used, but it's not great. But also, you couldn't really use 6 if you couldn't use Highway 10, which connects 6 to the gravel pit. So if 10's going to be closed and 10's not going to be approved, why even use 6 if you can't get from point A to point B?
Well, you're saying it was a engineering decision, but that's not what the jury found.
Well, we don't know what the jury found because there wasn't a jury instruction that MnDOT objected to, and that's that the word acceptable is ambiguous, and it's not. The word acceptable is what the engineer decides in his discretion using those 6 factors in the contract. And the jury was told they could look at course of conduct. They could go outside of the contract to basically reweigh and make their own. They could supplement the engineer's discretion with their own. And that's what's improper from the very beginning.
So you're saying this had nothing to do with politics at all?
Well, no. I think if John Large does not speak up at the pre-construction meeting, MnDOT probably approves these roads because they don't even know there's a problem with them. And they trust the county engineers to bring any issues to their attention. But once he speaks up, then they go look into it. And this discussion of an ulterior motive, this feud that was behind the scenes that Mr. Hart mentioned, there's only 2 witnesses who even testified about even knowing of this feud, one of whom is John Large. Well, he's not MnDOT, so his motive can't be grafted onto MnDOT because he's not them and he's never been them. And the other one was the county state aid engineer, Nathan Gannon, who testified, yeah, when they were looking into these roads, I went and got the plans from the county and passed them along. Otherwise, I wasn't involved at all.
Well, if it was a political decision, let's assume it's a political decision, is that bad faith?
No, and I would agree that even if it is a political decision, which we would dispute it wasn't, it was made for engineering purposes, MnDOT surely should be able to look into these. That's one of those interests, one of those factors they should be able to consider. Is this going to ruin the county if we put all the traffic in the county on one road? Like, let's say that's the hypothetical example here. They should be able to consider that as one of the factors, and whether that's going to be dispositive or not, in any case, I don't know, but it's surely something they can consider. It's one of those other factors that they should look into.
So doesn't that come down to a matter of reasonableness, of whether the political decision is reasonable or not?
Well, and it's got to be the higher standard of reasonable. It's got to be bad faith. The Whitestone case summarizes the jurisprudence from Minnesota to say it's
an ulterior motive.
It has to be more than unreasonable. It has to be evading the spirit of the contract. There has to be that intent to do something that they didn't bargain to do. It's just because somebody else would have made a different decision or somebody else thinks it was an unreasonable decision does not in and of itself make it a bad faith decision. It's got to be an improper decision. I see I'm out of time, Your Honor.
You are, but I have one more question.
You go ahead.
Judge Schmidt, why don't you go ahead?
Well, I had a question about the timing of this independent verification and testing that was done, because your opposing counsel mentioned that the testing was done after the roads were denied, and that you've said a couple of times that the independent testing was done to verify. So when exactly was that done?
Yes, to clarify the timeline, Your Honor, so April 25th is when the roads were first requested by CSI. Right after or during that meeting, that's when John Large says there might be an issue with those roads. MnDOT then goes and they do 2 types of testing: a pavement van, which is a van that has a camera that's visibly videoing cracks and rutting and that sort of stuff. I think it's just kind of shooting a laser in a video. That's what Mr. Kwasny, their expert, looked at. MnDOT's own evidence. And then the other testing is the falling weight deflectometer that Judge Johnson mentioned, where they have the van that has the trailer with a bunch of weights and they thump the ground every 100 feet, and then they measure the vibrations, which checks the subsurface soil. The pavement vans came out pretty quickly, and I think 2 of the 3 falling weight deflectometer tests were done in mid-May, but one of them they didn't get to until June. And when they got it, Mr. Strasburg, the engineer, even testified, it just confirmed my initial thoughts that it wasn't in good shape from my own visual observations. So yes, some of the testing wasn't done immediately. It was done about 6 weeks later because that was when they could get the equipment up there. I think there's only one or maybe two in the whole state. And so it's gotta coordinate the scheduling. But it wasn't as if this came back after the project was done. I mean, they came back basically when, at the time the project was just starting, they came back as quickly as they could, and it confirmed what they were already seeing from the other testing and from their visual inspections from driving the roads.
But was it done before or after CSI was informed they can't use the roads?
I think it was done, I think one of the roads was done after, and I think the other two were done before, but I'm not entirely certain on that date. I know at least one was done after, but I couldn't tell you the other two for certain.
Do you know that, is there a clear date when MnDOT communicated its decision to CSI?
I think the parties all agree. There was an email, and I don't have the exhibit number in at my fingertips right now, but there was an email sent roughly about 20 to 25 days, sort of mid to late May. I'd say roughly May 20th, give or take a few days, where there was a lot of communication back and forth where MnDOT was saying, hey, go find other alternatives. It doesn't seem like it's going to work. But MnDOT's position was, it's not acceptable until we say it's acceptable. And so while they didn't come out and just say no, they were saying, go find somewhere else. CSI was interpreting that as MnDOT not knowing, and MnDOT was interpreting that as, hey, we've already said no. We said, go find somewhere else. But the clear, no, it's not going to happen, came in late May.
And so do I understand your answer to Judge Schmidt's question that there were two types of tests? The first one, pavement van, and that was done before the email?
I think two of the three roads, the deflectometer was done before the email, one after, and I think the pavement van might have all been before the email. I don't have those dates at my fingertips either. The three deflectometer final data, like the Excel spreadsheet made via data, those were three of the exhibits. I think they might be exhibits 131 to 133. That might not be the right citation, but I'm pretty sure those are those. And, I mean, they're huge Excel spreadsheets with a whole bunch of kind of gibberish numbers, but those have the dates on the first page as what dates the three roads were tested. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Young. Thank you to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its decision in writing within 90 days.